The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Edison. Chapter 16, Part 2. In the meanwhile, Gorice the king sat in his private chamber, writing at a parchment spread before him on the table of polished marmalite. A silver lamp burned at his left elbow. The window stood open to the night. The king had laid aside his crown that sparkled darkly in the shadow below the lamp. He put down his pen and read again what he had writ, in manner following.
From me, Gorice the 12th, great king of Witchland and of Impland and of Demonland and of all kingdoms the sun doth spread his beams over, unto Corsus my servant. This is to signify to thee that thou shalt with all convenient speed repair with a sufficient strength of men and ships to Demonland, because that untoward and traitorly cattle that do there inhabit are to feel by thee the sharpness of my correction. I will thee, as holding the place of my general there, that thou enter forcibly unto the said country, and do, with all diligence, spoil, ravish, and depopulate that land, enslaving, oppressing, and putting to the death, as thou shalt think most serviceable, all them that shall fall into thy power, and in particular, pulling down and ruinating all their strongholds or castles, as Gailing, Dreppaby, Cruthering, Owlswick, and other. This enterprise in head is one of the greatest that ever was, since it is to trample down Demonland, and once and for all to cut their combs, whose crests may danger us. And thou art to understand that without extraordinary experience of thy former merits, I would not commit to thee so great a charge, and especially in such a time. And since all great enterprises ought to be suddenly and resolutely prosecuted, therefore this ought to be done and executed, at furthest, in harvest next. Therefore it is my commandment that thou, Corsus, take order for the instant furnishing of ships, seamen, soldiers, horsemen, officers, and particular persons, weapons, munitions, and all other necessaries, which is thought to be needful for the army and host, which shall be levied for the said enterprise, for which this letter shall be thy sufficient warrant under my hand, given under my signet of Ouroboros, in my palace of Carcy, this 29th day of May, being the 8th day of my year, 2.
The king took wax and a taper from the great gold inkstand, and sealed the warrant with the ruby head of the worm Ouroboros, saying,
"The ruby, most comfortable to the heart, brain, vigor, and memory of man. So 'tis confirmed."
In that instant, when the wax was yet soft of the king's seal, sealing that commission for Corsus, one tapped gently at the chamber door. The king bade enter, and there came the captain of his bodyguard and stood before the king, with word that one waited without, praying instant audience.
"And showed me for a token, O my lord the king, a bull's head with fiery nostrils graven in a black opal in the bezel of the ring, which I knew for the signet of my lord Corsus, that his lordship beareth alway on his left thumb. And 'twas this, O king, that only persuaded me to deliver the message unto your majesty in this unseasonable hour, which, if it be a fault in me, I do humbly hope your majesty will pardon."
"Knowest thou the man?" said the king. He answered,
"I might not know him, dread lord, for the mask and great hooded cloak he weareth. It is a little man, and speaketh a husky whisper."
"Admit him," said King Gorice. And when Sreeva was come in, masked and hooded, and holding forth the ring, he said,
"Thou lookest questionable, albeit this token opened a way for thee. Put off these trappings, and let me know thee."
But she, speaking still in a husky whisper, prayed that they might be private ere she disclosed herself. So the king bade leave them private.
"Dread lord," said the soldier, "is it your will that I stand ready without the door?"
"No," said the king. "Void the antechamber, set the guard, and let none disturb me."
And to Sriva he said,
"If thine errand prove not more honester than thy looks, this is an ill night's journey for thee. At the lifting of my finger I am able to metamorphose thee to a mandrake, if indeed thou beest aught else already."
When they were alone, the lady Sriva doffed her mask and put back her hood, uncovering her head that was crowned with two heavy trammels of her dark brown hair, bound up and interwoven above her brow and ears, and pinned with silver pins headed with garnets, colored like burning coals. The king beheld her from under the great shadow of his brows, darkly, not by so much as the moving of an eyelid or a lineament of his lean visage betraying aught that passed in his mind at this disclosing. She trembled and said,
"O my lord the king, I hope you will indulge and pardon in me this trespass. Truly, I marvel at mine own boldness, how I durst come to you."
With a gesture of his hand, the king bade her be seated in a chair on his right beside the table.
"Thou needest not be afraid, madam," he said, "that I admit thee, let it make thee assured of welcome. Let me know thine errand."
The fire of her father's wine shuddered down within her like a low-lit flame in a gust of wind, as she sat there alone with King Gorais the XII in the circle of the lamplight. She took a deep breath to still her heart's fluttering, and said, "O king, I was much afeard to come, and it was to ask you a boon. A little thing for you to give, lord, and yet to me, that am the least of your handmaids, a great thing to receive. But now I am come, indeed, I durst not ask it."
The glitter of his eyes looking out from their eaves of darkness dismayed her, and little comfort had she of the iron crown at his elbow, bright with gems and fierce with uplifted claws, or of the copper serpents interlaced that made the arms of his chair, or of the bright image of the lamp reflected in the table-top, where were red streaks like streaks of blood, and black streaks like edges of swords, streaking the green shining surface of the stone.
Yet she took heart to say, "Were I a great lord, had done your majesty's service, as my father hath, or these others you did honour to-night, O king, it had been otherwise." He said nothing. And still gathering courage, she said, "I too would serve you, O king, and I came to ask you how." The king smiled.
"I am much beholden to thee, maiden. Do as thou hast done, and thou shalt please me well. Feast and be merry, and charge not thine head with these midnight questionings, lest too much carefulness make thee grow lean."
"Grow I so, O king? You shall judge." So speaking, the Lady Sriva rose up and stood before him in the lamplight. Slowly she opened her arms upwards, right and left, putting back her velvet cloak from her shoulders, until the dark cloak, hanging in folds from either uplifted hand, was like the wings of a bird lifted up for flight. Dazzling fair shone her bare shoulders and bare arms and throat and bosom. One great hyacinth stone, hanging by a gold chain about her neck, rested above the hollow of her breasts. It flashed and slept, with her breathing's alternate fall and swell.
"You did threaten me, Lord, but now," she said, "to transmute me to a mandrake. Would you might change me to a man."
She could read nothing in the crag-like darkness of his countenance, the iron lip, the eyes that were like pulsing firelight out of hollow caves.
"I should serve you better so, Lord, than my poor beauty may. Were I a man, I had come to you tonight and said, 'O king, let us not suffer any longer of that hound Jus. Give me a sword, O king, and I will put down Demonland for you, and tread them under feet.'"
She sank softly into her chair again, suffering her velvet cloak to fall over its back. The king ran his finger thoughtfully along the upstanding claws of the crown beside him on the table.
"Is this the boon thou askest me?" he said at length. "An expedition to Demonland?"
She answered, "It was."
"Must they sail tonight?"
said the king, still watching her. She smiled foolishly.
"Only," he said, "I would know what gadfly of urgency stung thee on, to come so strangely and suddenly, and after midnight."
She paused a minute, then summoning courage,
"Lest another should first come to you, O king," she answered. "Believe me, I know of preparations, and one that shall come to you in the morning, praying this thing for another. What intelligence soever some hath, I am sure of that to be true that I have."
"Another?" said the king.
Sreeva answered,
"Lord, I'll say no names, but there be some, O king, be dangerous sweet suppliants, hanging their hopes belike on other strings than we may tune."
She had bent her head above the polished table, looking curiously down into its depths. Her corsage and gown of scarlet silk brocade were like the chalice of a great flower, her white arms and shoulders like the petals of the flower above it. At length she looked up.
"Thou smilest, my Lady Sreeva," said the king.
"I smiled at mine own thought," she said. "You'll laugh to hear it, O my lord the king, being so different from what we spoke on. But sure, of women's thoughts is no more surety nor rest than is in a vein that turneth in all winds."
"Let me hear it," said the king,
bending forward, his lean hairy hand flung idly across the table's edge.
"Why, thus it was, lord," said she. "There came me in mind of a sudden that saying of the Lady Presmyra, when first she was wed to Corund and dwelt here in Carcy. She said, all the right part of her body was of Witchland, but the left pixie. Whereupon our people that were by rejoiced much that she had given the right part of her body to Witchland. Whereupon she said, but her heart was on the left side."
"And where wearest thou thine?" asked the king.
She durst not look at him, and so saw not the comic light go like summer lightning across his dark countenance as she spoke Presmyra's name. His hand had dropped from the table edge. Sreeva felt it touch her knee. She trembled like a full sail that suddenly, for an instant, the wind leaves. Very still she sat, saying in a low voice,
"There's a word, my lord the king, if you'd but speak it, should beam a light to show you mine answer."
But he leaned closer, saying,
"Dost think I'll chaffer with thee? I'll know the answer first i' the dark."
"Lord," she whispered, I would not have come to you in this deep and dead time of the night, but that I knew you noble and the great king, and no amorous surfeiter that should deal false with me."
Her body breathed spices, soft, warm scents to make the senses reel. Perfume of malabathroom, bruised in wine. Essences of sulfur-colored lilies planted in Aphrodite's garden. The king drew her to him. She cast her arms about his neck, saying close by his ear,
"Lord, I may not sleep till you tell me they must sail, and Corsus must be their captain."
The king held her gathered up like a child in his embrace. He kissed her on the mouth, a long, deep kiss. Then he sprang to his feet, set her down like a doll before him upon the table by the lamp, and so sat back in his own chair again, and sat regarding her with a strange and disturbing smile. On a sudden, his brow darkened, and thrusting his face towards hers, his thick black square-cut beard jutting beneath the curl of his shaven upper lip, "Girl," he said, "who sent thee this errand?" He rolled his eye upon her with such a gorgon look that her blood ran back with a great leap toward her heart, and she answered, scarce to be heard,
"Truly, O king, my father sent me."
"Was he drunk when he sent thee?" asked the king.
"Truly, lord, I think he was," said she.
"That cup that he was drunken withal," said King Gorice, "let him prize and cherish it all his life natural. For if in his sober senses he should make no more estimation of me than think to bribe my favors with a bona roba, by my soul, in his evil health he had sought to do it, for it should cost him nothing but his life."
Sreeva began to weep, saying, "O king, your gentle pardon."
But the king paced the room like a prowling lion. "Did he fear I should supply Corund in his place?" said he. "This was a cocksure way to make me do it, if indeed his practice had might to move me at all. Let him learn to come to me with his own mouth, if he hope to get good of me. Other else, out of Carcy let him go, and avoid my sight, that all the great masters of hell may conduct him thither."
The king paused at length, beside Sreeva, that was perched still upon the table, showing a kind of sweetness in tears, sobbing very pitifully, her face hidden in her hands.
So for a time he beheld her, then lifted her down, and while he sat in his great chair, holding her on his knee with one hand, while with the other drew hers gently from before her face.
"Come," he said, "I blame it not on thee. Give over all thy weeping. Reach me that writing from the table."
She turned in his arms and stretched a hand out for the parchment.
"Thou knowest my signet," said the king.
She nodded, "Ay."
"Read,"
said he, letting her go. She stood by the lamp and read. The king was behind her. He took her beneath the arms, bending to speak hot-breathed in her ear.
"Thou seest, I had already chose my general. Therefore I let thee know it, because I mean not to let thee go till morning, and I would not have thee think thy loveliness, howe'er it please me, moveth such deep commanding spells as to sway my policy."
She lay back against his breast, limp and strengthless, while he kissed her neck and eyes and throat. Then her lips met his in a long, voluptuous kiss. Surely the king's hands upon her were like live coals. Bethinking her of Corineus, fuming at an open door and an empty chamber,
the Lady Sriva was yet content. End of chapter 16.